Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest today is our friend Sheldon Richmond from SheldonRichmond.com. Welcome back to the show, Sheldon. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Good to be with you again.
Good. Yeah, it's been so long since we've spoken. Hey, you wrote this article. It's called How to Respond to the Paris Attacks. So, how should we respond to the Paris Attacks?
I guess I could have called it How Not to Respond.
Yeah, well, okay. What should we not do? You want to start there? That's fine, too.
Well, we shouldn't, well, maybe it would be quicker to say how we should. Get the hell out of the Middle East.
Yeah,
and respect
but,
civil,
but,
respect
but.
Civil liberties at home. Next question.
Yeah, okay. The next question is, but. Come on. Bad guys. Terror, fear, strike, and kill civilians.
Well, look, as you have pointed out in recent days and in recent years, actually not so recent years anymore, this has been going on quite a long time. And as your guests have been pointing out over the last few days, especially, but again, routinely, this is not what happened in Paris. Was not a bolt out of the blue. It's always looked at that way. Robert Fisk had a very good piece the other day in The Independent that got picked up in a few places. I guess I found it at Counterpunch. Where he says, whenever something like, Paris happens or some big spectacular act of terrorism in the West, doesn't happen when it's, you know, something in Beirut, or even when a Russian airliner is down, because I guess the Russians are part of the other also. But anytime it's one of us, one of our cities that is a victim, the memory banks get wiped clean. So we forget anything that happened, the day before, not to mention weeks and years before, or even a century before. So, at least as far as the U.S. media is concerned, there's very little discussion of how the U.S.-led NATO coalition, which of course includes France, has been pounding areas in Iraq and Syria for quite a while now, what, a year and a half. France has specifically moved into Syria with air power since September. And so this is, this is not a bolt out of the blue. Terrorism, an article, my next article is probably going to be, are terrorists madmen? And by that I mean, are terrorists irrational? And by that I mean, are terrorists, is their conduct unrelated to the means ends framework that we understand as human action? And the answer is clearly no. It's
yeah,
not,
but you're just saying surrender to the bad guys.
Well, you want to cut to the chase, I see. No, I don't want to surrender to anybody. I want us to defend what liberties we have left and expand them rather than let them shrink anymore. We're on a path to shrinking our liberties because war, it's a cliche now, but it's true. I mean, that's why cliches tend to be true, because they get repeated so often, because they tend to have some truth value. War is the health of the state. If we intensify the war in Syria and Iraq and the Middle East generally, our liberties will suffer. And one way they will suffer is that this will provoke new terrorist attacks, which are against civilians almost by definition, I'd say. And I don't justify them. I don't think it's immoral to go and kill just people who are going about their business, walking down the street or sitting in a concert or cafe. That's immoral. It's evil. That we shouldn't have to even have to say that, but of course we do have to say it. But nevertheless, it's an inevitable, as inevitable as things can be in human affairs, consequence of the West, the U.S., making war on Arab and Muslim populations in the Middle East. And when that inevitable response occurs, the governments will crack down. And it will seem plausible to most people that it cracked down, that they cracked down, because they're going to say, please help us, do something, which is no coincidence, because I think the planners understand that that will be a response. Now, I'm not saying that's the reason they make war in the Middle East, so that there'd be terrorism, so that they can expand government. I don't know that that's how they think about it, but that is certainly a consequence. We know this from the great history written by Robert Higgs, and it's not surrender at all.
All right, well, so what about this now? I think probably you could go back 3 years, 4 years, 4.5 years maybe even, certainly in the last 3 or 4, you could find interviews of the two of us talking about the serious situation and talking about how with this unbelievable policy of our government being willing to, you know, and along with NATO and the GCC, willing to back the American people's enemies as long as they're attacking Assad in the form of the al-Nusra Front and whatever. I bet you we could find in those interviews where we predicted these kind of consequences. Thousands, I know that I've been saying on the show, I assume it must have been part of the discussions with you over this topic over the last few years too, that there are thousands of Europeans going to Syria to fight against Assad, and at least scores, if not hundreds, of Americans. And we know that our government's attitude is, oh, they're the good guys fighting against Assad, so they're not even trying to really keep track of who these guys might be. And or if they are, they're doing a half-assed job of it. And so at the time that bin Laden was killed, you know, Al-Qaeda, core Al-Qaeda, basically had been reduced to almost nothing. But that was 4 years ago. And Obama might as well have been the cartoon Islamic terrorist out of the right-wing ridiculous theories about him, to the degree to which he has built up the Al-Qaeda forces across North Africa and the Middle East. And, of course, it's because he thinks he's smart and getting American goals accomplished and whatever, not because he's a Muslim terrorist. That was a joke. But point being, he's done more for Al-Qaeda even than George W. Bush has done. Had done for Al-Qaeda. And so maybe, Sheldon, the question now is, what about now? Maybe what you're saying made sense a few years ago, but now Obama has been so successful at building Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State into such giant movements with tens of thousands of members that could be turned against the West and have motive to try to keep attacking us to draw us further in. What are we supposed to do about those guys?
Well, don't give them what they ask for. I listened to your interview with Robert Pape the other day, and you know, he's very good, but I like you, disagree with what he is recommending, which is that we sort of continue on doing what we're doing. He doesn't want some big all-out war, because that's what the ISIS apparently would like, to have the U.S. pour troops in there, which would help radicalize more Sunnis. So he wants the sort of middle position that Obama's taken. In fact, he praised Obama. But I asked the same question you asked him. You know, even if in some very abstract way that was a good idea, what makes you think, what makes anyone think that the guys in charge, Obama all the way down, know what the hell they're doing or will carry it out? I mean, that's the Nirvana fallacy we talk about in economics, right? Where you propose some ideal solution and say, hey, this is, you know, this ideal solution is better than any real world solution you can come up with. Yeah, great. Except you're never going to get the ideal solution. So we have to choose among realistic solutions, things that are actually on the menu. That's not on the menu. So that's the answer. I don't believe that if we were to declare a Ron Paulian foreign policy today and withdrew all troops and all special ops and diplomats and everything else from the Middle East, I don't believe that the toothpaste would thereby return to the tube. You know, it's out. There are people who have scores to settle. So I don't want to make this, I don't make this naive promise that if we just do, you know, what I'm recommending, all will be well. And we're an open society, fairly open. And so therefore there are always going to be soft targets. But I believe it will cut down the chances, minimize the chances, and make things safer than they would be by any other path.
All right, hold it right there. Let's take this break and we'll be right back. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back to the show. Talking with the great Sheldon Richman. Donate $100 to the show, I'll send you one of his books. Your Money or Your Life Against the Income Tax. We're talking about what to do, what the government should or should not do about the threat of the Islamic State in our post Paris attack era that we now live in. And Sheldon, you got cut off by the break there and everything, so I want to let you go ahead and say you were saying that you're not saying that if America adopts a non-interventionist foreign policy that the terrorism problem will just dry up and go away. What exactly is it you're saying then again?
Well, not overnight it won't, because look, the U.S. has been at this a long time, a very long time. Pre-9/11. Look, pre-Gulf War I, therefore pre the 90s when Clinton was starving Iraqi kids and bombing, in the north and the south because of the no-fly zones, and not permitting their infrastructure to get rebuilt so that people could have clean water and whatnot. It goes way back. Support for Israel goes very far back, and that means oppression of the Palestinians and refusal to either keep hands off or lean on Israel to deal fairly with the victims of occupation. So you have scores. People will want to settle scores, and they're not. I don't believe everyone's going to say, everybody over there who wishes ill to Americans is going to say, okay, they've adopted Ron Paul's foreign policy program, and they're pulling out. So let's just forget about that now. There'll be a few people who might want to still do something. So I'm not making any kind of promise. I think it would be naive to just say everything will be fine if we make this declaration and actually begin to implement it. But I think we would, we won't stimulate new animosity by killing kids and bombing hospitals and wiping out wedding parties and this kind of stuff that, tends to make people pretty pissed off. If this was happening in the United States, I think we'd see a lot of anger at whoever was doing this. Well, it happens over there, almost routinely, and I hesitate to even put the word almost in there. Innocents are getting killed all the time, and we act, we don't pay any attention to it. I mean, we meaning just the general hoi polloi. It's not our business, especially if it's being done by drone, where Americans are not at risk because they're sitting in Nevada, right, under some mountain or something, playing a video game, essentially. But people are dying over there and living with the fear. Even if they're not dying or getting injured, they live every day with the fear that they could be next. That's going to make people mad. So if we stop that, at least we stop producing new people with grievances. And we can begin to reverse it. I would do things, I agree with what Justin Raimondo wrote this week and also what Andrew Basevich has written. We need to turn our attention to our society, keeping ourselves safe, not by violating civil liberties, of course, but that's where the concentration should be. And I'd go a step further, and not that I think this is going to get adopted anytime soon. We need to begin to privatize and decentralize security. Property owners have the greatest stake in keeping their assets, their factories, their movie theaters, and et cetera, their airlines, their airports, safe. And I would move security from a, bumbling centralized bureaucracy, namely the U.S. government or even the state governments. I would move that down toward the property owners and let them network with each other and have entrepreneurship come to the service of keeping the American society safe. And otherwise, leave the Middle East alone.
Well, and people got to understand, too, that what you're talking about is privatization, not quote-unquote privatization, which is spelled entirely different. It has ironic quotes around it, and that's the one where government hires a private company to carry out the government business. Right. That's not what you're saying. You're talking about getting government out of it and letting the owners themselves have to do the hiring.
I want competitive privatization.
Right.
Not just government contracting out for monopoly.
It should be like one with an S and one with a Z or some kind of thing so that people can tell the difference between that. Because even libertarians get caught up not being able to differentiate. Oh, privately run prison. That sounds efficient. Don't! And miss the point about all the horrible, perverse incentives that come baked into a fascist arrangement like that. But
I guess we need to coin a word like competitivization.
Yeah. Okay. There you go.
We don't want just private management.
You say everybody. This guy Richmond is a genius. I like hanging around with you, man. You're smart. All right. So, but now there's the political problem of we see. You know, Obama pulled the last tens of thousands of troops out of Iraq on Bush's timescale because the Iraqis kicked us out. The faction that we helped win the war there kicked us out. And it doesn't matter that he escalated the entire surge war in Afghanistan and then the entire drone wars in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, the regime change in Libya, the support for the Al-Qaeda guys in Syria, just like the Republican Party wanted him to do. None of that counts. Obama has shown weakness. Obama is peacenik. Obama is Ron Paul. And that's why we have an Islamic State, because Obama reduced America's military footprint in the Middle East the slightest bit. And then, look, a bad thing happened. Lesson: can never leave anywhere again. And then we see that playing out. Obama announced in October on the 15th that, oh, yeah, by the way, we're staying in Afghanistan forever, because I'll be damned if I'm going to let them say that about Afghanistan, too. So the 10,000 troops are staying indefinitely, and special forces too, et cetera. So how are we ever supposed to do? I mean, I guess if it was Ron Paul, he would say, I don't give a damn about your argument. I'm right, and I'm still doing it anyway. But no Democrat is ever going to get us out of there as long as the right is going to argue that every bad thing happens whenever they withdraw the slightest bit is, you know, got the perverse cause-effect relationship there. So what are we going to do?
Well, you know, even if at first glance you like that strategy, you quickly realize it's a loser, because you'd have to then be everywhere, because the idea is, you can't let them have safe harbor in Afghanistan. Well, fine. So they move somewhere else. Now you got to be there. Then they move somewhere else. Then you got to be there. Before you know it, you need a military, and this would be unbelievably expensive. If there was no other argument against it, this should be decisive. We'd have to occupy the world. You literally, because they're going to be wherever you're not, so there can't be a place where you're not. Therefore, we'll have to have a huge military. I don't know, are there enough people of military age, even if you had conscription? I don't think there are. Is there enough money? Are you going to, are the people who want this going to want to cut everything else out of the budget? I mean, I'm all for cutting the budget to zero, but they want to seem to put it all into the military. This is something that Rand Paul hit Rubio on him, in just terms of spending $1 trillion. So it's obviously not feasible. The people you're aiming against are a moving target. If they can't be one place, they'll be another place. And we've seen this, right? Bush went into Afghanistan on the grounds that they had given safe harbor, the Taliban had given safe harbor to Al-Qaeda. We had to go. Great. So they moved and spread and metastasized and mutated, and they did all those things. And now they're everywhere, including Yemen, including Africa. History has already told us that's a bad plan. So what else do we need? You know, the other thing is, I thought there was a great piece in the op-ed page of the New York Times back on November 16th by Olivier Roy, called "The Attacks in Paris Reveal the Strategic Limits of ISIS." People should look this up. But one of the things a woman points out in this is that all the people who say they're fighting ISIS, almost all of them have different agendas, right? You talk about the confused agenda of the U.S. Is it against ISIS or is it against Assad and Iran? It depends on where you're standing, right? If you're on one side of the old Sykes-Picot line, we're against ISIS. If you're on the other side of the old Sykes-Picot line, we seem to be against Assad, which benefits ISIS. But the Turks aren't on the same page. They hate the Kurds more, and they're supposedly our best partner. They hate the Kurds more than they hate ISIS. The Saudis don't seem to be against radical Islamists or jihadis or whatever term we want to use. They want to get Assad. The Shiites don't want to help the Sunnis, especially in Iraq. And so nobody's even on the same page. How does that add up to a coherent strategy? And that's not going to change anytime soon. So even on these sort of more practical considerations.
Well, yeah, I mean, if they were going to do it, really make killing ISIS their priority, they'd have to completely abandon their allies, Israel, Turkey, Saudi, and the Gulf states, and realign with Russia and the Iranian crescent and say, like, that's it. Look, all right, we're Hezbollah's Air Force killing these guys.
When ISIS was going against
Not that I'm recommending
Palmyra,
that. I'm just saying that would at least be coherent, right?
Right. Patrick Coburn has pointed out that when ISIS was going to conquer Palmyra, the U.S. wouldn't bomb because that would have been helping Assad's forces.
Right.
So apparently they held back. So nobody even knows what side anybody's on, including the United States.
Well, and people are saying, well, maybe there will be a change now after Paris, but there wouldn't a change after Mosul? And we were joking about this right in 2014, that like, okay, now that they've declared a caliphate, now they're going to have to stop the war against Assad and back in the jihadists against Assad and go ahead and slowly somehow figure out how to turn the policy around on, but no, it's been a year and a half and they're still stuck on Assad's got to go sooner or later.
Right.
Sooner first. No, before peace breaks out, he's got to go still.
I'm no fan of Assad. He's a bastard, but I will add he's not as much of a bastard as some people say. I agree with Jonathan Marshall, my old friend Jonathan Marshall, that he did show signs of wanting to keep the civil war from exploding by sitting down and talking to people. I think that gets totally overlooked and forgotten by the American media and certainly by the U.S. government. So he's terrible, but that doesn't mean he's as bad as everybody says. Same thing with Putin. So, and I don't want to be on Assad, Putin's, and Iran's side. In other words, I don't want to be on the Shiite side. I don't want to be on any side. Anything we do is going to make enemies, and that will come home to haunt us. I want to liquidate the empire. That's my position. Liquidate the empire.
Well, and again, that can be from a libertarian Richmondian point of view or even just an American imperial point of view, that it would make sense. It wouldn't be as contradictory and insane as the current policy, but it would still be counterproductive and bad policy even to align in a consistent and coherent way with Russia, Iran, Assad, and Hezbollah against the Islamic State. Because as you're saying, all these consequences, then will just flow from that. And it makes all their propaganda true that, look, it's the whole Roman Empire and the Eastern, Russian Empire, too, allied with the Israeli Jews and the Iranian Shia Safavids all against us. And, what could possibly go wrong with that? You know what I mean? I'm sure that'll work out. Once we have the combination between the Americans, the Russians, the Iranians, and the Kurds occupying Mosul, Fallujah, and Ramadi, and the Islamic State, temporarily beat down, after that, peace is going to break out, and it'll be great.
Sure. And the boys will be home by Christmas.
Right.
Nobody wants to admit that the exceptional nation can't do anything constructive in this situation. We have to face that. If that bruises our national ego, so be it. It doesn't bruise my ego. I'm happy to embrace that idea. The exceptional nation, however you want to define that, is powerless to do anything constructive. It's not powerless to do destructive things. Oh, it's perfectly capable of doing destructive things.
Right.
Infinitely so. But it can't do anything constructive. Everybody's got their own agenda. As I said, its own agenda. Israel, I left Israel out of that, but you quickly mentioned it. Thank you. Israel, as we know from their neocon brain trust of back in the 90s, were writing papers. Dan Sanchez has written about it. I've written about it. Writing papers about how destabilization is a good thing. They didn't want the secular pan-Arab powers like Nasser in power. They were secular. They were putting down the Muslim Brotherhood and people worse than that. But no, they were not. They couldn't have them because that was a threat to Israel's autonomy. So they had to knock those out. And we've been doing that. We've been knocking out. The U.S. has been knocking out secular Arab regimes. They did it in Iraq. They did it in Libya. They're in the process of trying to do it in Syria, without realizing that this is going to create opportunities for the people that we now worry about in Paris and Washington and, you know, everywhere else. It's insane. And I use that word not in any technical sense. It's just insane to think the U.S. can go in there and do anything constructive. We got to wake up to the fact it cannot do it. It cannot do anything constructive. It's going to mess things up more. And it's hard to believe that things could get worse, but believe me, things could get worse.
Hey, let me ask you this real quick now. Are you worried at all about domestic backlash and bigotry against Muslims and that this is going to have very much of an effect?
I am somewhat worried about that. I mean, I still sort of have confidence that Muslim Americans who are here and, you know, been here for a long time, probably won't. I mean, there's been some bad stuff since 9/11. I don't think that will get worse. I hope I'm not wrong about that. I'm concerned with the reaction to the refugee question. What is it? 30 governors, 35 governors, Rand Paul and Cruz, Cruz wanting a religious test. And I'm very happy to see people at Reason and other places start talking about what people thought of Jewish refugees in the 30s, right? Saying, wait,
oh,
a second,
yeah, you saw that Jesse Walker piece?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
It's excellent. Yes, fear that Jewish refugees were Nazi spies. I am concerned about that. I hope that doesn't get anywhere, and I'm going to be writing about that.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, that was a great point, man. Good old Jesse Walker, dude. He's the best guy that got a reason for sure. All right, anyway, listen, I'm late. I got to go, but thanks very much for staying on and doing the show with me.
Always a pleasure.
All right, Sheldon, that's the great Sheldon Richman. He's at SheldonRichman.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF founder and president Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.